Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it to your iPod, iPad, MP3 player, or computer. Today we have an excellent show on a very current topic, which many e-discovery lawyers talk about or think about, but few have really good sense of what it means, or better yet, how lawyers or companies should be using cloud computing. It's the ephemeral concept of cloud computing, which now is making for an annual show on ESI Bytes. We did this last year, but for this show, I decided to bring in a couple of technology experts instead of mostly lawyers on the show to discuss what cloud computing means and how lawyers might be able to use these tools today in e-discovery. The first panelist is Steve Akers, who's Digital Reef's founder and chief technology officer. He's a highly successful entrepreneur. Steve has spent his career designing cutting-edge technology solutions that solve complicated and very large-scale business problems. He was a chief technology officer in Lucent Technology Inc.'s wireline business unit, where he worked closely with Bell Laboratories to deliver large-scale technologies for integrating data, optical, and wireless networking across a common set of IP technologies. Steve came to Lucent from Springtide Networks, a company he co-founded in 1998. During Steve's tenure, Springtide became the premier provider of IP service intelligence switches for enhanced data services over IP networks. Steve and his team architected and designed the wireless wireline and broadband platform that inspired the purchase of Springtide by Lucent in 2000. As chief technology officer and key architect at Shiva Corporation, a maker of remote access and virtual private networking equipment, Steve partnered with Nortel Networks to deliver remote access server and carrier-based VPN technologies. Steve's networking, storage, distributed file systems, and security experience also include key positions at Stratus Computer, Hewlett-Packard, and Apollo Computer. Steve holds a Master's of Science in Computer Science degree from Boston University, a Master's degree in Business Administration from the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, and a Bachelor of Science degree from Michigan State University. Great to have you on the show, Steve.
Thanks, Carl. Pleasure to be here.
Our second panelist is coming in to us from the UK, Justin Parry, Parry, who's
everybody has. Unless you're Scottish, everybody has trouble with it, I'm afraid.
Okay. And in my original outline, I added an N to it, and I don't know where the heck that happened. But Justin's a blogger, an analyst, and Mimecast's director of content and communities. Justin is a leading SaaS and cloud specialist. He authors the influential This Week in SaaS blog and runs the largest SaaS community in the world with over 23,000 members. Justin has been in IT for over 10 years, gravitating towards SaaS over the last five. He's consulted to companies, large and small, helping them create successful SaaS products and strategy. And before that, he was an officer at Endeavors Technology, the inventors of application virtualization. Justin's also our second ESI Bytes guest calling in from the UK this week. So thank God for the internet is all I can say. Justin, could you start by defining cloud computing and then tell me briefly how you got interested in cloud computing? And then, Steve, you can add how you got interested in cloud computing.
Sure.
So the most important thing when we talk about cloud computing is to really understand what part of cloud computing you're talking about. So the reason I say this is that cloud has become this enormous marketing term that people wash liberally about on technology at the moment. You know, it really is the technology and marketing term du jour. And that's really dangerous. And it's so important to understand what cloud actually is made of. And there are three main parts. So the first part is what we call infrastructure as a service. The second part is platforms as a service. And the service. So infrastructure as a service is really all about computing, and it's compute power on demand. So the leading players in this space are people like Amazon, Rackspace, Terramark, and you buy disk, network, and compute from them on a pay-as-you-go basis. And you'll notice that most of, you know, the defining factor of cloud computing across the technology stack is that it's all should be supplied on a pay-as-you-go or an on-demand basis, where you pay for what you use. The second part of the stack is platform as a service. And platform as a service is a bit like the elephant in the room at the moment. Not many people talk about it, and not many people know about it, but it's probably going to be the most important part of cloud computing in the next 5 to 10 years. Platform as a service is effectively where developers are given a space or the opportunity to run code or execute code without having to maintain the underlying infrastructure that that supports it. So they don't have to run databases, they don't have to have application servers, they don't need to run web servers. It's all done for them. And platform as a service, you know, the biggest players in this space are Force.com, operated by Salesforce, Microsoft Azure, and Google App Engine. So those are the three main players, and you'll see a lot more of that over the next 5 to 10 years, or even the next 3 to 5, because, you know, it gives developers the opportunity to scale apps without having to, you know, have run the technology underneath it. And lastly, and probably most famous, well, you know, there's a debate whether it's more famous, but certainly software as a service tends to be what people think of if they haven't heard of Amazon as cloud computing. You know, popularized by companies like Salesforce.com or, you know, technologies like RightNow, Concur for expense management. It's software, but delivered as a service. So it sounds obvious, but, you know, you tend to pay it on a pay-per-use basis or pay-per-user. And it's like the software of old, but, you know, there are some big differences. How does that work for you as a definition, chaps?
I think it's very good.
Go ahead, Steve. You could add to it more than I could.
No, but those are the definitions I use. And then, of course, there are cloud storage services, which you can use like a utility, like Amazon's S3. You know, Justin was referring to EC2 when he was talking about Amazon's Elastic Computing Cloud. They also have the S3 storage service, which a lot of people use. And then in that vein, there's also Google Docs. There are companies like Nervonix. But the big theme is, you know, you can use these services easily, elastically. You can sign up for a lot of them with a credit card. And that's the great allure, like Justin was saying.
So I'm a bit of a pedant, and apologies, because I wear two hats. I'm a blogger, analyst, and I'm an evangelist as well. So I think going back to the definitions, it's really important to understand exactly what you're buying, because from a legal perspective, that has massive implications, and from a governance, risk, and compliance perspective, and change of custody, and all the important things that law firms need to be able to resolve and get a grip of, it's so important to understand what part of the stack you're buying into. So S3 is the disk part of the infrastructure as a service piece I was referring to earlier, whereas Google Docs is actually software as a service. So
yes,
they're at the opposite ends of the stack, but they have completely different risk profiles, and you need to treat them differently when you're doing your due diligence.
I agree. We find people who talk about those in the same breath, so I guess that's why I was guilty of that. Talked to a large medical center here in Massachusetts, and I was stunned that the guy said, look, I have all this data, it's building up, I'm paying, you know, thousands of dollars for storage administration. He says, I would put this in Google Docs if I could. And I asked him why Google Docs and not Amazon S3. He didn't really understand the difference.
That problem is rife throughout legal, or I think any space that's talking about technology. I mean, I'm not a cloud expert, but I work with search and retrieval, and people, lawyers all the time confuse concept clustering with predictive coding, and they group it together, where concept clustering is sort of like hitting the sort button in your Excel spreadsheet, and it just moves data around. It's helping you spot things. But predictive coding, you're doing samples and then assessing the rest of the data. But a lot of lawyers seem to say, oh, that's different from what we did before, so they talk about those two approaches the same way. It's very similar. Yeah. I think it's technology.
Justin's point that you need to be really careful how you define what you're talking about as a cloud service and then understand the risk profile, which is why I brought it up, because I think his point is very well made.
Okay. Now, with those definitions, one thing that I think is important, since this show can go in a lot of directions, is, you know, to what extent do each of you touch the legal community or electronic discovery, since I think we're going to be talking about both. Justin, why don't you start, and then Steve, I'll have you add your background.
Okay.
So, you know, one of the hats I wear is being the evangelist for Mimecast. And Mimecast is a software as a service company. We help companies we call it cloud services for Microsoft Exchange. But the easy way to put it, or the nice way to put it, is we're like a cloud wrapper. And we provide services in three areas, which is security, continuity, and archive for Microsoft Exchange. And, you know, one of the things that we found is that the legal sector is particularly careful. You know, data is, you know, incredibly important to them. And to that end, you know, they're looking to solutions where they need to secure and archive their emails. And we deal with a lot of law firms. We're now over 60% of the top 100 law firms in the UK, and then obviously we scale down to much smaller firms. So we come into contact with illegal a lot, and we've really solved some of their big issues with cloud computing.
Okay, and your background, Steve?
So Digital Reef has a software as a service that we provide with our software, more specifically to legal service provider partners. Like we could partner with Mimecast, for example, and they may want to use some of our tools for, you know, very high-speed processing of specific kinds, or our more analytic tools that we have. But basically, law firms give us data, and we have a number of services from optical character recognition conversion, early case assessment, and we host Relativity as a review platform. So things that, you know, we really have to focus on to satisfy that market are the same things Mimecast does. You know, strong security and multi-tenancy. You know, if you're going to host a service, you know, and 50 or 100 law firms are going to use it, they have to, you know, make sure that you know how to keep their data straight, and you're not letting one law firm look at another law firm's data. You have to supply all the scale and power behind the scenes so that the data is not only secure, but the service is responsive and rapid, and you know exactly, there's a firm audit trail as to who logged in, who saw what, who searched what, and who saved those searches, and et cetera.
Well, Steve, what do you see as the biggest impediments for the acceptance of cloud computing in the legal community? We're still at the beginning of this sort of sales cycle, is my sense.
So for software as a service, the legal community is worried about, you know, the security of the data, you know, managing audit trails, and making sure that everything is secure and buttoned up. For cloud computing in general, the things that basically scare attorneys are that if your data goes up to a cloud service, their clients can't absolutely swear as to what went into the cloud and what's there at any given time. And so they caution a lot of major corporations against just putting anything willy-nilly in the cloud. For one class of Justin's cloud computing infrastructure, the infrastructure area and the platform as a service area, so I should say two areas, what they worry about are developers sending company data up to test their applications. We deal with a lot of multinationals, and their developers are using the elastic capabilities of the cloud. And developers aren't business people or compliance experts. So what they'll do is they'll often use internal company data without thinking about the risk of putting it in the cloud. And they'll run it for test cases. And making sure the data is scrubbed back out of the cloud is a big risk. And lawyers will often caution their clients about that. But for as-a-service, software as-a-service for early case assessment and review, lawyers are getting more and more comfortable with it after their IT staff do firm security audits. But those are two kinds of ends of the spectrum, if that helps.
So Justin, what do you see as the advantages of cloud computing for the legal community? And then we'll talk a little bit about electronic discovery with Steve.
So, I mean, I think, you know, Steve is right on the barriers first. You know, the security is always the number one barrier. But the reality is that the reason people feel less secure about cloud is because, you know, cloud is opaque. Its biggest advantage and the reasons why it's a technology transformation is because the technology details are obfuscated from the user, which makes it opaque from a security auditing perspective. So its greatest strength is also simultaneously its greatest weakness. So, you know, when you're looking at why cloud computing is so effective, and you asked me a question earlier, which I didn't fully answer, you know, which is why was I attracted to cloud? And I'm a technology early adopter, being an evangelist. I rush to stuff. And I was attracted to cloud because of its CapEx purchasing basis rather than the OpEx basis of, you buy it as an operational expense rather than a capital expense as you did with traditional IT. So I ran to it because of financial advantages. But the reality of the cloud is it helps businesses be more agile by obfuscating the technology details. You don't have to worry about scaling. You don't have to worry about uptime, things like that, adding new servers. It's all about mapping the cloud application to the business. So cloud helps businesses or IT departments be more agile, which drives agility into the business, which actually is IT's job for the business.
Yeah.
I want to add to that because, I've been an entrepreneur for a number of years, and I had a business that wasn't super successful, but I built it on cloud tools. It was a virtual law firm, and I had about 50, 60 clients after my first year, all using a tool called Basecamp to manage cases for small companies and a network of about 20 solo attorneys who each sort of specialize in an area, even though you can't say that. That's the way I was using them. And it worked great. I didn't have an IT staff. I was an MBA lawyer that understood technology, and all of a sudden I was able to put an infrastructure in place and have it be operational, and it worked great. You know, the problem was the credit crisis, and people paid me with credit cards, so I shut the thing down. But it wasn't the IT that was hurting me. The IT was actually really enabled me to implement rapidly an idea I had.
So here's a really important point that I say to when I speak at conferences. I tell every audience I talk to. Gartner did some work recently asking what is the production function of IT? And, you know, this concept sounds really academic, but, you know, not many people give the right answer. Very, very few, in fact. Very few CIOs, IT managers understand actually what IT is there to do in a business. And, you say, well, what's sales production function as a comparison to IT? And sales takes prospects and turns them into orders. And then you think, well, what's the supply chain do? The supply chain turns orders into invoices. And what about finance? You know, what does finance do? So finance turns invoices into cash. You can see really clearly, you know, what the inputs were and what the outputs were. But IT is hard to see, isn't it? You know, what does IT do for the business?
Right, so, right. It's very hard to quantify. So as you say, you know, being able to justify it on an operational expense basis just makes things a lot easier. Because when you take a capital project to the CIO, he's looking for ROI and payback and all that stuff. And it's just it's hard to do because everyone benefits from innovation in IT.
So Gartner did some really interesting work, and they realized that IT's job is to deliver speed and scale. You know, IT helps businesses do things faster that they perhaps couldn't do before, and it helps scale processes at less cost. So, you know, if you add those two things together, IT should be about agility. And the problem for IT people and IT in the past is that the table stakes have been too high for what you had to do to achieve agility, and you had to spend so much of your budget on maintaining what you'd already purchased. So, you know, the big analysts reckon most companies spend over 75% of their budget on maintenance, just keeping the lights on. And
That's correct.
The best companies spend 25% on innovation. And in a CapEx and maintain model, you know, only one in three projects were successful. So
doesn't that open the door for businesses to attack existing businesses with a quicker, more agile model because they don't have the legacy of infrastructure?
Yes, I believe in that strongly, and I see a lot of demand for that. To tie some of this all together, so I think companies are striving to be more agile. I think the IT person, right, needs quicker ways to market, and I think virtualization in the cloud and behind their own corporate firewall is coming together to make this possible. Let me give you an example. So, with the legal general counsel inside, you know, a Pfizer or a Merck or a large company, what they want to hear from the IT guy is, hey, I use this agile new service, and I have an audit trail that shows that I have captured, you know, what data can move safely to the cloud, and what class of data needs encryption before it moves to the cloud, and I can give you some assurance that data is safe if I'm using a cloud service of some kind. So virtualization. So software delivered in VMware containers that can be downloaded as part of the service, have that code running in the VM on virtual infrastructure inside the firewall, identify different classes of content that exist in SharePoint servers, which are a big problem, storage systems, file servers, have that content then classified, identified, and moved off to an archiving service like Mimecast or Bloomberg or something else. That's a turnkey service with a comprehensive compliance audit trail that IT can easily justify, that assuages the concerns of the inside corporate counsel and makes the outside counsel happy, that e-discovery can be done in the future if need be, and there's a trail of compliance.
So Justin,
yeah, I mean, we call it strong chains of custody. You know, that's so important with cloud computing to get over those two things, you know, secure and auditable.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about the governance issues, because this seems like it's going in that direction right now, where, you know, how do you, set up your rules to make sure that this works, to get people comfortable, that they can get it back and they can see what's up there and get rid of it when they want to.
Sorry. So my frustration about this is that I think security and governance is treated like quite a binary object, like it's either on or off. I don't know if either of you two have experienced IT people saying, oh, it's not secure, it's secure. You know, you get this very binary approach, don't you?
Yeah. What I was getting at before is, entire services are being developed. You know, like Justin's company has done a great job virtualizing, you know, a cloud service around Exchange and Exchange services, right? What I hear people talking about is, hey, if you can extend that service securely into my cloud with a download of a VMware module, which runs some code, which helps me have visibility into my data, so then I can securely move the data I have behind my firewall into the cloud and give me an audit trail, right? Now I have a place to set my policies. The cost of adoption is not huge. And so virtualization technologies have made this possible by allowing one to bring into their firewall a piece of the service that runs securely behind the corporate security infrastructure. And as Justin's pointing out, it's a way of life. It's becoming a way of life. it isn't binary, it's on today and off tomorrow. It's these standard tools are going to get developed, they're going to get downloaded into the enterprise infrastructure, and then people will say, well, governance is just something I do every day. I know where my data is, I know what it is, I know what classes of it I have, I know what I have to protect, I know it's safe to move to the cloud. And oh, by the way, Mimecast has a great way to put it in the cloud.
So, and I think I would go one step further. You know, when I present the the argument that people think security is binary, it's often, you know, because there's not a brilliant understanding of the governance, risk, and compliance procedures behind managing data, and it totally depends on the type of data you're talking about. So, if you've got, you know, if you've got very, very sensitive data, then you need to treat that differently to not very sensitive data.
Right. So, that's what I was getting at with classification.
Yeah, you've got to classify your data. If you don't classify your data, then you're going to treat everything with a one big stick, and you're not going to give the business the agility it needs.
You right. Know,
governance and risk management is all about managing the risk of doing business, so that to ensure that you deliver, you know, what your fiduciary duty to your shareholders and your customers. It's
yes.
not about locking everything down. It's about delivering agility with an acceptable amount of risk. So I think the most important thing to do is baseline your current risk. And the problem for many businesses today is that, you know, the IT budget, IT departments aren't given the budget they need to, you know, implement something like, you know, ISO 27001 or SAS 70 or, you know, a standard internally. You know, they're not given the resources to do it. And the problem they've got is, you know, who watches the watchman? And I'm not going to try and pronounce the Latin. I'm rubbish at Latin. I don't know if you two are any good at Latin. You know, something like quus ipsodis. I don't know. I try every time, and I shouldn't. But cloud gives people the opportunity to be the watchman. So, you know, to really look at where areas where they can take advantage of being the watchman instead of being, you know, the guard, if that makes sense.
Right.
So, you know,
we shall guard the guardians.
Exactly. So the most important thing is to think about, how secure is my data today? You know, how good are my security controls today? What is my uptime today? And better for uptime and security than an on-prem environment, because some recent research shows that cloud providers spend 20 times what on-premise providers do on an equivalent piece of security.
Yeah, they have to, or the business model will die, because that's the biggest concern.
Absolutely. Nobody's going to buy from an insecure provider.
Well, I want to bring this back into, not back into the real world, but present another real world issue. I did a real interesting show with three records managers a few weeks ago, where we talked about really the art of managing records, because it's not a science. You know, you acquire company A, company Z, you know, you downsize, you get rid of things. You know, this data is volatile and it comes in different forms. And most companies, at least in the U.S. that are larger, grow, you know, a large part through acquisition. And so I mean, e-discovery is just one subset of trying to get your hands around data. Let's talk about taking two companies and putting them together when each have cloud applications, because that's would seem to be your more likely scenario, you know, for a big mass.
I look at this from the real world, you know, because we deal with our customers acquiring companies every day.
Okay.
And, you know, pre-cloud, and, you know, what happened was companies acquired other companies, and their IT systems didn't get fully integrated because there just wasn't the ROI from the integration projects, was there?
Yeah, it's a mess.
You know, it's a total mess. So you end up with this spaghetti sauce of IT systems that don't deliver the ROI that they need to, maybe haven't delivered the ROI that they were supposed to, and nobody's got the budget or the ability to do anything about it.
You get the data you can out, and you keep the legacy system sitting there gathering dust because everyone's scared to get rid of it, and oh, my God, that's sitting there, and it's not doing anything.
Right.
Or or your current systems don't even have the capacity to absorb the legacy system, even if they could.
That's true. And, you know, this goes back to the insight issue. You know, companies just have no idea what data exists within their infrastructure, you know, let alone in the cloud. And it's just a huge problem unless you can identify what you have and classify it so you can identify the risks and the value of the data. If you acquire another company, you know, their entire storage arrays full of old data, and most companies will tell you, I have no idea what's in that data. I kind of wonder if I shouldn't mothball it, see if anyone's even used it, because I'm afraid to look. You know, I may find it.
I mean, I take a slightly different angle as well, which is that, you know, from a scariness of not knowing what's about, just take PST files where people, you know, people run out of space in their Outlook, so they archive to a local PST, which you can't back up or sync with any of the Microsoft technology. So it's literally stuck on people's laptops. Now, what if they're important, contract negotiations or, you know, agreements? How do you go back and discover those when they're on laptops that are being traveled around with salespeople? I mean, companies do some really scary things with their data because they're not aware or they haven't had the ability to deal with it before. And I think cloud gives you the opportunity to do things properly for the first time.
Yeah, but it sounds like you have better infrastructure opportunities in the cloud, but it also sounds like there's always, at least right now, a human aspect that we tend to do poorly regardless of where we're storing, which is analyzing your data.
Well, you know what? I don't agree, actually. I think you're going to be a lot better off with a cloud provider because searchability and scalability is baked in from day one. So, you know, yes, if you buy hundreds of different SaaS and cloud systems so they're not unified, if you had 15 different ERP systems in the cloud, for sure you're going to end up with a worse discoverability. But if you adopted one archiving platform across globally or one storage platform globally, that's going to be way more discoverable than, you know, 150 different systems in local offices or even 15 different cloud systems.
I agree with you. What we're finding is people want to do that, but the big issue is what we were talking about before. They have all this legacy data. They have SharePoint popping up everywhere where people are creating, downloading, you know, moving things in. PST files end up on SharePoint servers all the time. So that stuff from a discoverability perspective is a nightmare. And then having something, this is what I was talking about, a way to flexibly analyze your data behind the firewall. It's that kind of stuff you want to analyze and decide, yeah, this really does belong up in the cloud storage service. It's been tagged and analyzed, and now I can shove it up there. And I can not only free up storage resources on the SharePoint farms and et cetera, but I can know my risk profile, right? So it makes the cloud service more valuable. And you're absolutely right. People want to do that. It's just one huge issue is finding the stuff they want to put up there and assessing the risk profile.
Really nice new tools, which I would call on-ramp tools, that do that for you. So they put your data in the cloud and then manage the interface to your local network, either through a virtual machine or some very clever hardware with some acceleration in it.
Yeah.
So I think those problems are definitely going away. I don't think we need to be scared of the cloud, assuming you've done your due diligence on the provider.
No, I'm not saying we need to be scared of the cloud. I'm saying these kinds of tools need to be deployed so that you can make the best use of the cloud. People want
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just a lot of them aren't sure of what tools to use, how to assess and analyze their data behind the firewall, and then how to securely move it to the cloud.
Can I ask another question about the cloud? And I'm presuming this risk is the same even if you buy internal equipment, that the people that make the internal equipment go under. There are a number of cloud computing platforms out there. You mentioned Amazon. I think Microsoft has a place in this area. Google. I know they play different roles, but the actual platform to store on, these companies need to figure out a revenue stream out of this. And some of them will and some won't. What happens if you bet on the wrong one?
Yeah, there are a number of issues with that. So, for example, when your data goes up to a cloud, one thing you do need to worry about is if that cloud provider goes into bankruptcy, then that's not your data anymore. It belongs to the bankruptcy court. This is sort of off topic, but that's one of the things that came up in a recent conference panel I chaired at the Masters Conference last month.
Yeah, I mean, I know some developers that build in the cloud, and this was one of the, they said, oh, I'm going to bet on one that I bet on, and the tools are going to be compelling, and we'll help that cloud space prosper. Yeah, but anyway, I just sort of want to throw that out there. I'm playing the lawyer on this.
it's really hard. I mean, and the problem is that you're betting on stuff that's hosted rather than on-prem, so you don't have actual control over the data like you did in the past. It's really hard to escrow data and source code because basically it's useless to you. I mean, I think in the next couple of years, we'll see some data escrow services for the cloud be much more prevalent. There are already a few out there, Backupify. I mean, you could argue that, Mimecast is an escrow for, Exchange email, wherever you put it, with our archive. So there are ways and means to get around these issues.
Can you handle them contractually, though? I mean, do you think having good contracts with your cloud provider that makes it clear that it's you're renting their technology, but the underlying data is still yours to avoid that bankruptcy issue? Or is it too intermingled with the apps?
I think it's an edge case. I mean, I have seen some things. I think that's taking it to the nth degree because ultimately the data should be yours. I did see a blog post recently about the bankruptcy court owning the data, but I don't think that's the natural conclusion, if that makes sense. I think there are a lot more options before then. But again, I say this to everyone: you've got to do your due diligence. Scaling and running and operating a subscription business is not straightforward. The economics of subscription businesses are totally different to those of software companies. And you need to do your due diligence, just like any supply. This is an outsourcing business, basically, and you've got to do the same due diligence on outsourcing to cloud as you would to outsourcing anything else.
Okay, now let's end up with the main area of ESI Bytes, which is e-discovery. When we're talking about e-discovery, I mean we're talking about litigation and trying to preserve your data and analyze your data and produce it to the other side. When it's in the cloud, that obviously creates issues as well. What's your take on that, Steve?
So what we find is that in the infrastructure space, right, if something becomes discoverable, right, one huge headache for companies is, this is not Mimecast where you're buying a service and discovery comes with it, which works quite well. This is your other data, which may relate to your business that's part of an e-discovery. So that kind of data, you have to basically go through a lot of hoops because it doesn't necessarily relate to a service you can just use to discover it. So you have to pull it all down. You have to send it somewhere to be analyzed. So in that case, it's a huge headache for e-discovery. And a lot of companies are doing things like, I'm going to at least index the metadata of the content that goes up to the cloud so I know what went there. Okay, so this is like a belt and suspenders approach. For people who are using services, like Salesforce and stuff like that, right, that's more the you're kind of buying a SaaS model of a certain type of service, right? Those e-discovery capabilities aren't really in all of those platforms. So again, it becomes kind of a headache because you have to go through a lot of documents and attachments and a lot of things that end up you know, posted to your Salesforce.com. People are using one big headache that's becoming prevalent is people are buying a lot of SharePoint hosted services, and people are posting all sorts of things up there, and the discoverability is in question because SharePoint in itself is not really it's not a records management platform. It's a collaboration platform.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes very difficult to tell who put something there when. The tools for discovery are really not always implemented in these services, so the customer ends up having to pull all the stuff back and do e-discovery behind their firewall. So these are all things one needs to consider when they start, you know, getting the provisionability of these services. That's one day when e-discovery rears its ugly head, they have to think about, you know, the time, expense, and effort it's going to take to pull that stuff back and do a proper e-discovery.
I mean, one of the analogies I would use today is, you know, everyone's got cell phones and PDAs, and they do chatting and things like that. I don't know of anyone that's been able to go to a carrier and say, give me all the chat stuff, because they're deleting, they're not storing it, they don't, because of the challenge, and that
Correct.
Keeps the price low. When you're talking about your records, it's not being deleted, and now you have to deal with it, and that might impact the price of the offering down the line as the path has to go back and forth a little bit more to deal with litigation, or it's inaccessible.
And I think there's a really the old adage is true. You know, you can't get cheap, good, and quick, and a lot of the services that are catching people's eyes are the really cheap ones, and you know they might be cheap and good, but they might not be quick for e-discovery. So
right.
You know, we encourage our clients, and I sound like a broken record, is just make sure you do your due diligence, that the tool fits your needs, especially for e-discovery.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to sort of wrap up on this. And I'll complete the story by talking about the wind down of my virtual law firm, which I was using Basecamp at $40 a month to store all this data and didn't have to have any technology. When I decided to wind this thing down, and give the individual lawyers the cases they were working on, it was a real pain in the butt downloading data. We basically had to print and hand off files and go back to the old way because the ongoing concern was disappearing. But we got in business real quickly. It was wonderful at the beginning. It was a pain at the end. But I guess, you know, that's your point, Justin. You can't have everything.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, wife calls it, exactly. You know, do you want the moon on a stick? Is her favorite phrase. And our answer is always yes. I would say that, you know, when you're thinking about contracting with a cloud provider, just like any outsource contract, you need to think about the birth, the life, and the death of the contract. You know, or divorce actually is probably more appropriate.
Yep.
And those three things are so important to think about in the lifetime of a cloud contract. How easy is it going to be to leave? You know, we make it really easy for our customers to leave. They can have any of their data at any time exported in a vendor neutral format. And we're very upfront about it. If you're not happy, then you can get your data out in a great format. And it's really important that, you know, like your experience is that you see that, you get that from your provider. And the likelihood is that is not going to be the cheapest provider, but you have to, you know, you have to be aware of those risks.
And I guess at the end of the day, legal risks are very, very important, but you don't grow a business by focusing 80% of your effort on trying to, you know, deal with the 1% probability of something going bad at the expense of being a viable business or better business.
And that goes to my point, right, you know, about halfway through, to, you know, which was businesses are run by business people. Governance is to manage an acceptable level of risk versus the agility that the risk gives the business. It's the business's fiduciary duty to manage that. If you can get what you need, 99% of what you need out of a very cheap tool, and you're happy with the level of risk that introduces into your business, then absolutely go for it. But you've got to be aware of the risks that introduces.
Okay. Well, I think this has been a great show. I don't know if either of you have anything else you want to add, but, you know.
I think it was a great discussion. It was great to meet you and Justin. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Justin and Steve, for joining us on another show here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have experts such as you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com for a complete list of our show. You can also remember our show and website phonetically, as it sounds out, Easy Bytes. Of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Jurnov, wishing you a nice day.